I was hoping you had a copy of the original will, Rolvag interjected.
Of course I do. But getting back to Chaz, what makes you so sure he's not the forger?
Because the new will would establish him as the prime suspect in your sister's disappearance. It gives him a big reason for killing her, which is one thing our case has been lacking. One of many things, the detective might have added. To be honest, Rolvag went on, I don't think Chaz is foolish enough or even greedy enough to put himself at such risk.
Corbett Wheeler hooted. And I think that's exactly what he wants you to think. Come on, man. Who'd go to all the trouble of setting him up?
That's what I'm trying to find out. Rolvag didn't share with Corbett Wheeler the possibility that someone aboard the Sun Duchess had witnessed Joey's murder. He was always careful not to raise the hopes of a victim's relatives.
It would be helpful to see the will that you've got, Rolvag said.
No problem. More static. It's in a lockbox in Auckland.
Could you FedEx a copy?
How about if I deliver it in person, Joey's brother said. The detective tried not to sound too excited.
That's even better. But I thought you weren't ever coming back to the States.
Me neither, Carl, but things have changed, haven't they?
On the other end, Rolvag heard what sounded like the soft pop of a bottle being opened. The detective felt a sudden craving for a cold Foster's.
Corbett Wheeler said, It looks like my late little sister needs someone to see after her interests. And by the way, the real will doesn't leave me anything either, in case you're wondering about my motive.
The detective assured Joey's brother that he wasn't.
When will you be arriving? He asked.
Day after tomorrow. The service is next Thursday.
Again, Rolvag was caught off guard.
What service?
The one I'm arranging in memory of Joey,
Corbett Wheeler replied with a muffled burp.
Can you recommend a nice church, Carl? Catholic, Lutheran, Methodist? Doesn't really matter, as long as there's room for a choir.
As Red Hammernut listened to Chaz Perone's story, he thought of the many blessings that had come his way, but also of the toil. A big farming operation like his was a challenging enterprise, relying as it did on rampant pollution and the systematic mistreatment of immigrant labor. For Red, it was no small feat to keep the feds off his back, while at the same time soaking taxpayers for lucrative crop subsidies and dirt-cheap loans that might or might not be repaid this century. He reflected upon the hundreds of thousands of dollars that he'd handed out as campaign donations, the untallied thousands more for straight-up bribes, hookers, private yacht charters, gambling stakes, and other discreet favors, and finally the countless hours of ass-kissing he'd been forced to endure with the same knucklehead politicians whose loyalties he had purchased. This was no easy gig. Red Hammernut got infuriated every time he heard some pissy liberal refer to the federal farm bill as corporate welfare. The term implied contented idleness, and nobody worked harder than Red to keep the money flowing and to stay out of trouble. Now the whole goddamn shebang was in danger of falling apart because of one man.
Pay him. That's my advice, Chaz Perone said in cocksure summary. I know it's a shitload of money, but what else can we do?
They were sitting in Red Hammernut's office, overlooking the toxic, though tranquil, pond. Chaz and Tool had driven straight from Flamingo to La Belle, arriving at 4 in the morning and nodding off like junkies in the parking lot. Chaz's nostrils were blood-encrusted, and his face was pocked extravagantly with crimson insect bites. Red Hammernut couldn't help but stare. The man looked like a photo out of an exotic medical textbook.
"He's got us by the short and curlies," Chaz was saying of the blackmailer. "I don't see where there's any other choice but to pay him."
Red Hammernut said there was never only one choice, regardless of the problem.
"But let me see if I understand the situation, 'cause you tore through it pretty fast. What about the cop? The one you thought was breaking into your house and talking like Moses on the telephone."
"I was wrong. It's not him," Chaz said shortly. "He's not mixed up in this."
which is at least one piece of semi-good news, right?
Except he found out from the dealership about you buying me the Hummer.
Well, hell, Red Hammernut said.
So I told him you were friends with Joey, and you did it as a favor to her, got me the Hummer for my birthday, and then she paid you back.
That's the best you could do? Sweet Jesus.
Red Hammernut turned to look at Toole, whose head was lolling.
You all right?
Just real tired.
Then go lie down.
Yes, sir. That's an idea.
Toole kicked the chair away and curled up like a bloated bear on the carpet in front of the desk. Red Hammernut shook his head.
Chaz said, So if the detective asks you about the Hummer...
Don't worry, son. I'll give him the same story you did,
Red Hammernut said.
Now let's talk about this blackmail business. Some bitch wants $500,000... And for some reason, you think I'm the one ought to pay.
Red, I don't have that kind of money.
My question is, what's he gonna do if you don't pay? Worst case.
Tell the cops he saw you push poor Joey overboard.
Chaz bleated.
Isn't that enough?
First, he's gotta prove he was on board that ship.
Don't worry. He was.
Then it's his word against yours.
Red Hammernut thinking how the media would go wild once the accusation became public. So far, Chaz had demonstrated no capacity for steadiness under pressure, and Red Hammernut doubted that his composure would improve once he was named a murder suspect. If Chaz had in fact killed his wife, he might come unspooled under tough questioning by the cops. That could prove catastrophic for Hammernut Farms, and even more so for Red personally.
This asshole knows everything, Chaz was saying.
Red Hammernut clicked his teeth.
Yeah, I heard you the first time.
Knows about the Hummer, the phosphorus tests, don't ask me how, but he put it all together.
Bad luck,
Red Hammernut said. It was his own damn fault for buying that H2. He'd done it only because he was sick of hearing Chaz whine about needing a four-wheel drive. The way Red figured it, the blackmailer probably hired a private eye to do a paper check on Chaz, which led him to the Hummer's bill of sale. Once Red's name popped up, it wouldn't take fucking Matlock to make the connection between the farm and the biologist who was testing its waters for pollution.
It's a terrible fix, I give you that,
Red Hammernut said to Chaz.
But $500,000 big ones ain't a very appetizing option.
But Joey left me Zippo, Red. All I've got is what's in the bank.
Red Hammernut calculated that he'd slipped Chaz $20,000 to $30,000 in cash over the years, most of which had probably been pissed away on green fees and lap dances.
Relax, boys. Let's put on our thinking caps.
Reaching into the bottom drawer of his desk, Red pulled out a bottle of Jack Daniels and poured three glasses. Toole slurped his from a supine position.
So, how long till he wants an answer?
Red Hammernut asked. He said he'd call Monday morning, Chaz said.
And he ain't alone in this deal, right? You said there's a girlfriend.
Toole spoke up from the floor.
Name Anna something or other. She don't know much.
Good,
Red Hammernut said, though he had marginal confidence in Toole's assessment.
She wasn't totally scared to pieces of you?
Toole grunted.
Didn't appear to be.
Don't you think that's strange?
Chief, I give up trying to figure out women a long time ago.
Amen, said Chaz Perone.
Well, let's assume the girlfriend knows what the blackmailer knows,
Red Hammernut said,
and proceed from there. Who's ready for another belt?
Toole raised his glass for a refill.
When can I go home, Red?
Soon as this mess is over. Won't be long, I promise.
I miss my yard. All them pretty white crosses.
Just hang in there, son,
Red Hammernut said.
You're doing a world-class job.
Chaz Perone cleared his throat.
To be honest, Red, there's room for improvement. No offense, but it needs to be said.
Red Hammernut hoped Chaz would have more sense than to complain about Tool in Tool's presence. But he was wrong.
Take last night, Chaz pressed on. I end up all alone with that psycho blackmailer in the middle of the friggin' Everglades? In a canoe?
You're alive, ain't you? Tool said.
Red Hammernut couldn't see over the edge of the desk, but it sounded like Tool was scratching himself.
Yeah, I'm alive. No thanks to you, Chaz snapped.
Then appealing to Red,
the bastard hit me over the head with a paddle, and look what he did to my nose.
Red Hammernut tried to sound sympathetic.
Guy's got a mean streak, that's for sure.
I thought the whole point of having a bodyguard, Chaz griped, was to protect me from shit like this.
Tool raised his head, and by way of rebuttal said,
There weren't enough room in that canoe for all three of us.
Then how about the other night at the house, Chaz needled. The man kicked your ass.
We ain't gonna talk about that, Tool said.
Water under the bridge,
Red Hammernut agreed.
He's got to be 50 years old, at least, Chaz went on. And he damn near killed you.
Tool's tone hardened.
Now you're just telling stories, boy.
Red Hammernut's patience ran out.
Both of you, I swear. You shut the hell up. This ain't no kindergarten.
Chaz fidgeted while Red slowly sipped his drink. Tool dozed off and began to snore. After a few edgy minutes, Chaz let it rip.
What do you think, Red, about paying the guy?
I think you got some brass balls, considering you're the one got us into this train wreck.
Chaz looked wounded.
Why? What did I do?
Red thinking,
that's the $500,000 question.
This is serious, Chaz persisted. Whoever this guy is, he could take us all down.
Of that fact, Red Hammernut was keenly aware.
Wait outside, son. I need to have a word with Mr. O'Toole.
Good idea. Chaz headed confidently for the door. Maybe he'll listen to you.
Red Hammernut walked around to the other side of the desk. With the toe of an ostrich skin boot, he nudged Tool in the ribcage. The big man looked up dolefully and blinked.
Red, please don't send me back to Boca fucking Raton.
How about I double your pay to $1,000 a day?
Tool sat up.
The doc killed his wife.
Yeah, you're probably right,
Red Hammernut said.
He hired a woman over, did I tell you? Ain't been with it a week and already he's poking poon.
If he were the Pope of Rome, said Red, I wouldn't need your help.
Tool, still itching, unhooked the straps of his overalls to improve access.
Truth is, Chief, I ain't cut out to be no bodyguard.
Truth is, that ain't your job description. Not anymore.
Samuel Johnson Hammernut winked and slapped an envelope fat with cash on the desk. Tool brightened.
I'll take another drink, he said.
Red passed the bottle. 21. Joey was baking in the sun, stretched out on the seawall, when she saw the glint of an airplane high overhead. It made her think of her parents, and she had to smile, picturing that doped-up circus bear in the co-pilot's seat of the doomed Gulfstream. Hank and Lana Wheeler had lived and died with a flair that Joey envied. In that spirit, she removed the top of her bikini and tossed it on the dock. It landed on the nose of Mick Doberman, who awoke with a curious snort. From out on the water came a rowdy hooray, followed by the sound of clapping. Joey spun around and blushed. Two men were motoring slowly past the island in a dark green flats skiff, no more than 50 yards from the shore. The men were in their late 20s or early 30s and wore loose-fitting pastel fishing shirts of the style found in high-end outdoor catalogs. Strom shot to attention, shook free of the bikini top, and began to bark. When Joey covered her breasts with her arms, the fishermen booed. She lay down and closed her eyes, hoping they would go away. She had come to cherish the solitude of the island and to appreciate Mick's antipathy for uninvited visitors. Strom was clattering up and down the dock in a slobbering rage that would have deterred most sensible persons, but the glimpse of a half-naked woman had obliterated what scant common sense was possessed by the young men in the green skiff. Joey could tell by the engine noise that they were edging closer. Idiots, she thought. Even in the middle of Biscayne Bay, there was no way of avoiding this distinctly male brand of bad behavior. A sea breeze delivered their randy chuckles and lewd, low-toned commentary, one of the men offering a favorable critique of her legs while the others speculated hopefully on the presence of a tattoo. In vain, Joey prayed that their frat house blather would be drowned out by Strom's manic barking. Yet when she looked up again, the boat was no more than 60 or 70 feet from the seawall. "Hey, babe," one of the men said, "let's see those tits again." Joey could easily imagine Chaz in that skiff, making the same smirking, cloddish approach to a total stranger. Calmly, she got up and walked to the shed where Mick stowed his fishing tackle. He'd been teaching her how to cast a spinning rod, and it seemed like a good opportunity to practice her accuracy. Distracted by a second sighting of her breasts, the two fishermen failed to take note as Joey tied the large plastic minnow to the line, a hefty deep-sea plug bristling with multiple sets of treble hooks. Strom circled deliriously as Joey advanced, weapon in hand, to the end of the dock. The young man in the bow of the skiff was emitting a gargling sound, presumably in appreciation of Joey's physique, as she drew back the spinning rod. His gaze never left her chest, so he didn't see the fishing lure arcing brightly through the noonday sky. Joey wasn't sure if she snagged his shirt or the flesh of his neck, but in any case, she jerked hard enough to spill the howling imbecile into the water. She had reeled him halfway to shore when Strom, surrendering to ancient instincts, sprung off the dock and lustily attached himself to the thrashing angler's thigh. His companion bellowed in alarm, but gave no thought to heroics. Instead, he jammed the skiff's throttle into reverse and backed smartly away from the island. The tumult was still in evidence when Mick Stranahan arrived a few minutes later in the whaler with Rose, Joey's worldly friend from the book group. Strom released his grip on the fisherman and paddled somewhat ineffectively toward Mick, who with Rose's assistance hauled the slippery dog into the boat. Making no move to unhook the swimmer, Stranahan bit through the fishing line and instructed the driver of the skiff to come fetch his dumbass partner. The cucumber-sized lure remained attached like a garish brooch to the floundering man's shirt. Joey also spotted a ragged hole in his cargo shorts, Strom's zestful contribution, as the man clambered over the gunwale of the skiff, which immediately departed at top speed. The wild scene seemed surreal to Rose, who hopped off the whaler, hugged Joey ferociously, and exclaimed, "You're the hottest-looking dead person I ever saw." Joey noticed that Rose had bleached her shoulder-length hair to a hue of blonde that would have impressed the Gabor sisters. She wore a pullover, black tights, and white high-top sneakers, on her way to the gym, no doubt, when Mick had intercepted her. He pointed toward the receding speck that was the green skiff heading for the mainland. "Those jackasses give you a hard time?" "They tried," Joey said, "but Strom and I taught them some manners." Mick pulled her close, kissed her neck, and whispered, "Better put your top on. You're getting fried." While Rose and Joey caught up, Mick set the picnic table and fixed a lunch of conch chowder, grapefruit salad, sardine sandwiches, and sangria. It was a coolish day, and they took their time, Rose frequently interrupting Joey's story to rail against Chaz Perrone. "That son of a bitch," she said for at least the fifth time. "I still can't believe he pushed you overboard." Joey said, "And I can't believe I didn't break my neck." "You still haven't gone to the cops?" "This way is better. This way I'm getting answers." "Speaking of which," Rose said, rummaging through her handbag, "I think I found what you wanted at the library." She produced a folded stack of Xerox newspaper clippings. Stranahan grinned as he read the first headline aloud. Local farm cited as Glades polluter.
Surprise, surprise, Joey said.
Rose noisily attacked a carrot stick.
So tell me, who is this Samuel Hammernut? And what's he got to do with your husband?
He owns him, Mick interjected, or so it appears. Joey told Rose about the water testing that Chaz did in the Everglades and about the new Humvee purchased for him by Hammernut Farms. Rose gave her a consoling hug and said,
No offense, sweetie, but I always knew that man was a whore.
So, what's next?
My brother's flying into Lauderdale on Monday.
Rose looked intrigued.
The one from Australia, who nobody's ever seen?
New Zealand, said Joey. You and Corbett are the only ones who know I'm still alive. Besides Mick, I mean. Who, by the way, wouldn't even tell me how you two met. Joey gave Mick the are-you-kidding-me frown.
He saved my life, is all, she said to Rose. He's the one who pulled me out of the ocean.
Rose reached for the pitcher of sangria.
That is so incredibly romantic. He actually saved you? Like, from drowning?
Sharks, too, Mick added dryly. And giant mutant octopi. Joey pinched his earlobe. She was glad that he'd cooled off since last night at Flamingo. He had been furious to hear that she'd left the motel room to chat with Chaz's bodyguard. Rose said,
I assume that your brother's coming here to kick Chaz Perone's cowardly ass.
He'd love to, but no, said Joey. He's arranging a memorial service for me at some church in Boca. There'll be a notice in the papers. Rose looked at Stranahan and then back at Joey.
You guys are bad.
Not compared to Chaz, Mick said. Rose set down her glass and rubbed her hands together.
So tell me, what can I do to help?
Joey said, You can come to the service.
Of course.
And hit on my husband. Rose thought about it for a beat or two.
Do I have to sleep with him?
I'd rather you didn't, Joey said.
Charles Regis Perone had a bounty of experience dealing with aggrieved women, and for Rika, he pulled out all the stops. 12 dozen long-stemmed roses, Godiva chocolates, a magnum of Dom, all were delivered to her apartment that Saturday afternoon. Still, she wouldn't pick up the telephone. Her adamantine refusal to make contact was exasperating, but also arousing. A tough, take-charge side of Rika that Chaz had never seen. He was confident that once she agreed to meet with him, he could win her back with his dependable arsenal of stage charm, counterfeit sincerity, and unforgettable sex. As he rang her doorbell for the third time, Chaz checked his pockets for the potent blue pills that would, if all else failed, endow the ultimate persuasion.
Go away,
Rika said from the other side of the door.
Sweetheart, please.
Fuck you, Chaz.
Honey, this isn't fair.
When Chaz heard the click of the deadbolt, his spirit soared. The door opened, and Rika said,
What the hell happened to you?
Mosquitoes.
Your ears look like rotten guavas.
Gee, thanks. Can I come in?
You've got 5 minutes.
Chaz stepped inside. He tried to hold her, but she pulled away.
Where are all the roses? He asked.
Dumpster,
Rika said. Chaz winced, thinking of the bill from the florist.
The champagne I poured down the toilet, she added.
I see. And the chocolates?
Oh, those I'm keeping, Rika said. Except for the nougats. You've got 4 minutes left.
She was standing against the door, one hand poised on the knob. She wore rumpled sweats and no makeup, and she looked exhausted.
What's going on? Why won't you see me? Chaz asked.
Because you killed your wife.
Who told you that?
A guy who saw the whole thing.
Chaz felt the blood draining out of his skull. He backed against a chair and sat down.
Rika said, He saw you push Joey overboard. Told me exactly how you did it.
And you believe him?
Chaz's voice fluttered like Slim Whitman's.
How you grabbed her by her ankles and flipped her backward over the side, she said. God, I haven't slept in 2 nights. The guy's shaking me down is all. He heard about Joey on the news and... This is a first for me, Chaz, dating a wife killer.
Hold on! You're taking the word of some stranger, some dirtbag scammer.
You told that detective I was your cleaning lady.
There was frost in Rika's voice.
The cleaning lady?
Chaz cursed to himself. He remembered Rolvag bracing him about the phone call from the lobby of the Marriott. The cop didn't even have his notebook open at the time, so Chaz hadn't given it a thought. The sneaky bastard must have total recall.
Rolvag came to see you?
Rika nodded heavily.
Asking all kinds of questions.
Chaz tasted bile and swallowed hard.
Well, what was I supposed to tell him, Rika? That I was calling my girlfriend? The guy's looking to nail my ass.
No shit. He went to all the trouble of tracing the call.
I'm sorry. So sorry, Chaz said. You've got no idea how bad I feel.
Rika showed no sign of melting.
Here's my question. How come he doesn't believe you?
The cop? Oh, please. Chaz laughed scornfully. He's just trying to make a reputation for himself, busting a doctor for murder.
Rika rolled her eyes as if to say, not that doctor thing again. Let's go grab a bite to eat.
I'm not hungry, she said, and your time's up.
Chaz was stunned to see her open the door and motion for him to go.
Don't do this, he said. Don't give up on me so easy. I'm begging you, Rika.
And by God, he was begging.
It's over, she told him.
One drink. Give me a chance to change your mind.
No, Chaz.
One lousy drink. You won't be sorry.
All right, but not here. You'll just end up trying to talk me into bed.
Chaz was swept by relief. Name the spot, he said. Rika selected a bar at a nearby bowling alley for its thunderous lack of intimacy. Saturday was league night, and Chaz would have had more success making himself heard over a cruise missile attack in downtown Baghdad. While Rika went to the restroom, he fished out the bottle of blue pills, and seeking to avoid a repetition of his painful tryst with Medea, tapped only one into the palm of his hand. He swallowed it dry and checked his watch. The magic mojo potion should start working in an hour, by which time he hoped to have thawed Rika's heart. When she returned, Chaz ventured a tender squeeze of her elbow, which she yanked away as if he were infected with some pustular disease. He was flabbergasted by her animosity, which seemed unshakable, and also by her self-discipline. He had plowed through 3 martinis before she finished half a Miller Lite. Over the symphonic clatter of bowling pins, he apologized repeatedly for the cleaning lady reference, which he calculated to be more of a sticking point than his wife's murder. Still, Rika didn't cave.
"Time to go," she said.
"Not yet. You've gotta let me finish." Chaz considered himself a master bullshitter, but the cheap vodka seemed to have blunted his improvisational skills. He found himself blurting, "Didn't Rolvag tell you about Joey's will?"
"Nope," said Rika. "Anyhow, you said she was giving all her money to the animals, yaks and pandas, you said."
"Well, that's what she told me, but... yesterday, that cop shows up at the door with a new will and asks, what do I know about it? A will that Joey signed like a month ago."
"Whatever, Chaz."
"Honey, she left everything to me."
"Why would she do an idiotic thing like that?"
Chaz leaned forward and dropped his voice.
$13 million.
"That'll buy you lots of cigarettes in prison. You should learn to smoke."
"Ha, ha," Chaz sneered.
But he was crestfallen. He could hardly believe that the news of his future fortune hadn't rekindled Rika's ardor. What had happened to that frisky, free-spirited girl who tinted her pubic hair and shaved him a shamrock?
Don't you understand what this means? He persisted. Think of what we can do with $13 million. The incredible places we can go, all the cool stuff we can buy.
Chaz, you snuffed your wife.
How can you say that?
Take me home, Rika said. Right now.
In the parking lot, she remarked upon his oddly stilted gait. Twisted my knee, he mumbled.
Doing what? Climbing off the bar stool? Turn around and let me see something.
Just forget about it.
Chaz, turn around!
He was too vain to refuse. Even in the face of such impenetrable frigidity, Chaz believed that a glimpse of the thickening bulge in his pants might win Rika over. Her reaction, however, was empty of delight or anticipation. All she said was,
"Are you serious?"
Chaz dusted off a golden oldie.
"I can't help it, honey. See what you do to me?"
"Wow. Would you like me to fix it?"
Chaz incautiously moaned in the affirmative. Rika kneed him, and he moaned again, though this time not from desire. She said,
"I want to go home. Can't you get that through your head?"
He drove in silence, his mind blaring. Rika was definitely going to be a problem, a humongous problem. While she couldn't implicate him directly in Joey's disappearance, she would be valuable to prosecutors seeking to lay out a seedy scenario for murder. The pretty mistress, to go along with Chaz's windfall inheritance. Judging by her disposition, Rika would be pleased to do her civic duty and testify against him. With little coaxing, she would share with salivating jurors a luridly embroidered account of the affair, as well as her current low opinion of Dr. Charles Perrone as a human being. Her appearance in court would be devastating. Chaz said,
"Tell me honestly, you really think I threw Joey overboard?"
"Yep."
"You'd believe a total stranger? Some scumbag drifter who shows up at the salon and gives you a wild story?"
Rika said,
"I know when men are telling me the truth. It doesn't happen often, but when it does, I know. And P.S., he didn't exactly look like a scumbag."
"Are you kidding? The guy's a fucking animal. He nearly beat me into a coma with a canoe paddle."
"I'm so sure."
"Check out my nose."
Chaz was amazed that she seemed to be taking the blackmailer's side. Suddenly he remembered Tool's intriguing revelation. The blackmailer had a girlfriend.
"Oh, Jesus," thought Chaz. Now it made sense. The asshole tracks down Rika, tries to pump her for more dirt. She says, "No way, not unless you cut me in on the score. Next stop, Flamingo." Rika must have been the girl that Tool had seen on the docks. She was in on the scam.
"Just how much did you tell this guy?" Chaz asked warily.
"Which guy? The cop or the blackmailer?"
"The blackmailer."
"Nothing, Chaz. All I did was listen."
"Yeah, right." Rika glared.
"Screw you."
"And what about Rolvag? What'd you tell him?"
"I told him I wasn't really your maid. I made a point of clearing up that little misunderstanding."
"Ah," Chaz said. "So now he knows all about us."
"He would have found out anyway."
"I suppose so." Rika said,
"Hey, you missed my street."
"What other choice do I have?" Chaz wondered.
"Where are you going? Turn around,"
Rika demanded. Chaz reached under the seat for the Colt 38, which he had reloaded before leaving the house. He pointed it at Rika and said, "We're not going home."
"What? Now you're gonna rape me?"
"Don't flatter yourself." For 20 minutes he headed west on a road that followed the Hillsborough Canal toward the Loxahatchee National Wildlife Refuge, a sprawling preserve on the eastern apron of the Everglades. Rika stewed silently while Chaz held the pistol in his left hand, dead level with her heart. He was surprised how composed he felt, how confident and clear-headed.
Once, when Rika began fiddling with the door lock, Chaz raised the .38 to her temple. His arm remained straight and steady. In the glow of the dashboard, he could see Rika staring at him with wide, fresh eyes. Finally, she was scared. Chaz turned off on a dirt trail that led to a locked metal gate. Whistling to himself, he flicked on the high beams, aimed the Humvee down a steep embankment, and rumbled along a shallow ditch until he had bypassed the barricade. Then he gunned it back up the slope onto a narrow, rutted levee, where nothing but night-cloaked wilderness lay before them.
"Oh, God,"
Rika said. Chaz remained silent. Focus was essential. When he killed Joey, he never lost focus, never strayed from the script, never left the zone. Rika said,
"Since when did you buy a gun? I thought you hated guns."
With the tip of the blue-plated barrel, Chaz touched a button on the CD player, and the Hummer filled with a blast of George T. and the Delaware Destroyers. That nasty slide guitar obliterated Rika's yammering, and Chaz slipped gratefully into the buzz of the music, which was better than popping speed. He drove down the levee for another 15 minutes before he braked and ordered Rika out. She stood squinting into the headlights, brushing the insects away from her face, and trying not to break down. Chaz felt a subtle, ugly gnawing in his gut. He would have much preferred a silent ambush, as with Joey, but Rika had left him no such option.
"So it's true about your wife,"
she said, her voice tight. "Yeah, I'm afraid so."
"Chaz, how can you do this to me?"
"Same way I did it to her." He sat on the hood of the Hummer and aimed out between the headlights. Later, Tool would help him get rid of Rika's car and clean out the apartment, make it look like she skipped town.
"You can't kill me, Chaz. You cannot do it," she declared. "Joey wasn't looking you in the eye the way I am. She didn't know what was coming."
This, Chaz lamented, is exactly the sort of sticky scene I wanted to avoid. He said,
"What I can't figure out, if you cared so much about my wife, how come you were sleeping with me?"
Rika seemed to shrink.
"Well," said Chaz, "because I was a fool."
"Keep going."
"And selfish,"
she added hoarsely. "Now we're getting somewhere. Tell me about you and the blackmailer," he said. "Is it strictly business, or are you screwing him, too?" Rika bristled.
"My God, you're cracking up."
She cupped a hand over her brow so she could see him better.
"Your hand's shaking."
"Like hell it is."
"Take a look, Chaz."
"Just shut up."
"Plus, you still got a boner. What's that all about?"
Chaz had been hoping with all his soul that she wouldn't notice. Those fucking pills were unbelievable.
"It's bad enough you're pointing a gun at me," Rika said. "But that too?"
He estimated that she was no more than 30 feet away, an easy shot. "Turn around," he told her.
"I'll do no such thing."
The marsh beyond was teeming with jumbo alligators. Beyond the headlights, Chaz could make out half a dozen pairs of large eyes glowing like embers. Rika's corpse would be gone by daybreak. What the gators didn't eat, the turtles and raccoons would. She said,
"I'm not turning around."
"Then hold still." Chaz sighted down the short barrel, gripping the .38 with both hands the way he'd seen it done 1,000 times on television.
"Jesus, she's right. I'm shaking like a damn wino. Chaz, you don't know what you're doing."
"Hold still," I said.
"This is a major mistake. The fuck-up of all fuck-ups."
He held his breath and pulled the trigger. Rika shrieked but did not fall.
"You rotten little cocksucker," she cried, hopping up and down. "That's not even funny."
"Swell," Chaz thought. "She thinks that I missed on purpose. Or maybe that I'm shooting blanks." He stiffened and again took aim, wondering, "How in the name of God did I not hit her? She's 100 times bigger than that friggin' rabbit." The second shot caught Rika in the left leg and spun her one full rotation. To Chaz's surprise, she still didn't go down.
"Look what you did!"
She clutched at the punctured limb.
"Are you fucking crazy?"
Incredible, thought Chaz. I should have brought a buffalo gun. Another mosquito stung his cheek, and he swatted himself so violently that he slid off the hood of the Hummer. Rika capitalized on the distraction, gimping into the darkness with surprising swiftness. Chaz collected himself and took up the chase, lengthening his stride when he spotted the blur of gray sweat togs ahead of him. He was closing the gap when Rika suddenly vectored off the rutted path and, to his profound amazement, dove headlong into the swamp. Chaz aborted the pursuit instantly, for nothing so terrified him as the prospect of entering the piss-warm water of the Everglades in total darkness. Gagging on soggy duckweed, being lashed to ribbons by the serrated sawgrass, and finally getting sucked, one leech-covered leg at a time, into the inky, inescapable muck. Not me, thought Dr. Charles Perrone. No thanks. As Rika tried to swim away, he stood on the embankment, firing his pistol until she rolled over and sank with a gasp. Before long, his ears stopped ringing, and the water glassed off and the night hummed back to life. Chaz peered at the spot where Rika had gone down and observed nothing but a fleet of water beetles skating back and forth in the reflected starlight. Something substantial splashed farther away in a thicket of lily pads, probably just a coot or a garfish, Chaz thought. But why push my luck? The place is lousy with gators, and I'm out of bullets. He jogged back to the Hummer, spun a nifty 180, and headed back toward town. His heart was thumping like a baby sparrow's, but he felt lightened and liberated and pleased with himself for turning the hated, haunted swamp into an accomplice. 22. Carl Rolvag said, "You look lovely this morning, Nellie."
"Coming from a degenerate like you, that makes me want to hang myself. You heard about poor Pinchot."
"I did," the detective said. "They find him yet?" Mrs. Shulman was bobbing from side to side, trying to see past him into the apartment. "Poor Pinchot isn't here, Nellie."
"Then you don't mind if I look around?"
"Actually, I do." Rolvag didn't want her to notice that the snake tank was empty. She snarled.
"I wouldn't put it past you, kidnapping some poor little puppy for your own depraved pleasures. You probably made a video of it. You probably put it out on the internet."
Daffy old bat, thought Rolvag. "I did not feed Bert Miller's dog to my snakes," he said, almost adding, "but accidents happen." Mrs. Shulman said,
"Well, you certainly enjoy hearing those helpless little mice shrieking in agony. Just imagine how much fun a Pomeranian would be."
"That's a totally irresponsible accusation." The detective choked down a sneeze. Nellie Shulman had drenched herself in a perfume that stunk like rotting gardenias.
"Then why can't I come in? It's Sunday morning, after all."
"Because you called me a degenerate," Rolvag said.
"Well, you are. Anyone with a thing for snakes is a sick, sick bastard."
She tried to sneak past, but he lowered a shoulder and blocked her.
"The Millers are devastated," she declared.
Rolvag already felt terrible. He had searched the grounds of Sawgrass Grove for 3 hours, but the only snake he'd found was an ornery black racer that bit him on the thumb of his left hand.
"I saw you prowling around outside yesterday," Mrs. Shulman said, "hunting for more tasty little dogs."
"Nellie, have you been mixing your medications again?" She poked him in the belt buckle.
"Just because you're a cop, you think you can get away with anything. Well, you're wrong, mister. We're going to evict your heathen butt just like we evicted Neville. And he was a deacon in his church."
Gordon Neville, a retired highway engineer, had been forced to leave Sawgrass Grove after a bawdy after-hours shuffleboard match with two women he'd met during outpatient physical therapy at Imperial Point.
"We nailed him, and we'll nail you too,"
vowed Mrs. Shulman. Rolvag closed the door firmly in her face. He was halfway to the bedroom when he heard a rustle behind him. He hoped it was one of the missing pythons, but it turned out to be Nellie sliding another flyer into his apartment. The detective picked it up and morosely looked at the photograph. Missing. Our beloved darling Pandora. Blue point Siamese kitten, rhinestone collar. Easy to identify. Seven toes on her right front paw. Please return her to the Mankiewiczes at Sawgrass Grove 17G. Reward? Our eternal gratitude. What else can I do? Rolvag wondered. Snakes can't be baited and trapped like bears. His shrub-to-shrub search having failed, all that remained was for the pythons to reveal themselves. The detective had already decided not to take his pets to Minnesota, the climate there being hostile to tropical reptiles. Leaving them at large in Sawgrass Grove, however, would be perilous not only for the domestic fauna, but for the snakes themselves. Many of Rolvag's elderly neighbors shared Mrs. Schulman's harsh sentiments and had no interest in seeing the pythons captured alive. A garden rake or the business end of an orthopedic cane would do the job nicely. Rolvag ate a light breakfast, showered, and packed an overnight bag, including a map of the Everglades agricultural area. The map had been provided by Marta, Charles Perrone's supervisor at the Water Management District. She had helpfully marked in red ink the dirt roads and levees upon which Dr. Perrone normally traveled to collect his water samples. Although the map didn't provide the names of the deed holders whose property abutted the wetlands, Rolvag had shaded with a number two pencil the approximate boundary of Hammernut Farms. The detective wasn't surprised by what the red line seemed to show, but he needed to see for himself. Before leaving the apartment, he opened the window overlooking the courtyard on the wildly improbable chance that his snakes might find their way home. "You've been awfully quiet today," Joey said. "Not that you're ever a chatterbox." Through the bay window they could see Rose flailing in the kayak. Twice already she had flipped it, although she'd gamely declined assistance. Stranahan said, "I whacked your husband with a paddle last night. I should have told you, but I didn't." "Don't sweat it. He gets on everybody's nerves." "I even thought about killing him," Stranahan said. "So? I think about it constantly." "There's a slight difference." "I know," Joey said. "I'm only fantasizing. You've actually done it before." "Right. And it messed you up." "I've finally gotten to where I sleep through the night."
"We're not going to kill Chaz or any such thing. You said so yourself."
Joey kissed Mick on the mouth, leaving him gloriously dizzy. She said, "Thanks for putting up with all this. You deserve a medal." "It's not too late to bail. Go to the cops and tell them what he did."
"Not yet."
Rose had tipped over again, and Strom had leapt in to help. The gulls in turns were pitching a fit, but Rose was laughing uproariously as she helped the clumsy dog get to shore. "This whole thing could blow up on us," Stranahan said, half to himself. Joey squeezed his arm.
"Everything's under control."
Stranahan wasn't so sure. The cast of characters, himself included, was undisciplined and in varying degrees unstable. Falling for Joey was a prime example. It wasn't part of the plan, but Stranahan was doing it anyway. And the harder he fell, the more powerful was his urge to beat the everlasting shit, and ideally a confession out of Dr. Charles Perrone. Stranahan told himself to get a grip. Joey said,
"You're thinking about us, too, I can tell. The big picture."
"Unfortunately, my resume speaks for itself."
"Well, it's true I've never been with anyone like you," she said. "But I'll bet you've never been with anyone like me, either."
"That's a fact." Last night he challenged her and Rose to write down the names of all the Beatles, a screening protocol for younger women that in past times had saved Stranahan from certain doom. Rose had gotten only 3 out of 4 correct, but Joey Perrone had passed with flying colors, crediting a BBC special that she'd watched one night on the History Channel while Chaz was out with his buddies at a titty bar. Stranahan had to smile, for there was no point in pretending he could walk away now. In Joey's presence, he was helpless and driven and probably happy. Someday she would leave, as they all did, and he'd return to his slow-motion existence, revolving peaceably as it did around a dog, a boat, and some corroded fishing gear. This was the embedded cycle of his life, as predictable as the tides. Joey nudged him and said, "Mick, stop already. I can hear the gears grinding." "Sorry." "Relax, okay?" She peeled out of her swimsuit and led him toward the bedroom. "And that's an order," she said. Chaz Perrone dreamed he was being mauled by a 15-foot alligator with two hungry heads, one chewing on his left leg and the other chewing on his right, a mad contest to see which gobbling maw would reach his crotch first. He woke up wailing and saw Toole standing expressionless at the foot of the bed. "Just a nightmare," Chaz said, trying to compose himself. He was soaked with perspiration, which he hoped was a result of the dream and not the feverish onset of West Nile virus. The night before, he had counted 34 mosquito bites on his face, and at the moment, every one of them itched like poison ivy. Toole said,
"Your mother's on the phone."
"Jesus, what time is it? Tell her I'll call her back."
"Tell yourself, dipshit. It's your ma, for God's sake."
Chaz had detected a menacing chill in Toole's attitude since they'd left La Belle. In retrospect, he wondered if it had been unwise to badmouth the man in front of Red Hammernut. As soon as Toole left the room, Chaz picked up the telephone and heard a familiar question from Panama City. "Any news, son?"
"No, Mom."
"How are you holding up?"
"Some days are better than others," Chaz answered sorrowfully. It was still important to appear needful of sympathy. "Don't give up hope yet."
"Mom, it's been like 9 days. Nobody can survive that long in the ocean without food or water. Think positive thoughts," she said.
"Mom, please.
Didn't you see Castaway?"
Chaz Perrone sucked his teeth. His relationship with his mother had delaminated during his late teens and early 20s, though not because of her marriage to Roger, the wiggy RAF pilot.
Rather, Chaz's mother had come to notice and comment often upon the fact that her son was failing to outgrow the more obnoxious traits of his adolescence. Her list included laziness, habitual self-gratification, a deep-rooted lack of ambition, and a reflex aversion to truthfulness. Chaz refused to address the merits of these charges, instead bitingly informing his mother that it would be folly to take career advice from a senior cashier at Target. Once he'd received his doctorate at Duke, Chaz's mother apologized tearfully for having doubted him. He made a fuss about forgiving her, but in fact, her opinion had never mattered enough to either wound him or warm him. He indulged her with a phone call every so often, but it was purely an act of charity. His mother would ramble on about how proud she was, how marvelous that her only son was using his brilliant scientific knowledge to save the Everglades from human destruction. She was such a liberal drip. It was pathetic. She had adored Joey, too. Another reason that Chaz wasn't eager to chat. "Miracles do occur," his mother was saying. "Roger and I have been praying for her every night."
Chaz sighed. "Joey's gone, Mom. They'll never find her."
"Have you thought about seeing a psychic?"
"No." "Have you thought about getting a brain scan?" Chaz slammed down the receiver.
"Dingbat," he grumbled.
"Ain't no way to talk to your mama."
It was Toole again, filling the doorway like a load of bricks. Chaz foolishly advised him to mind his own damn business, at which point Toole snatched Chaz off his feet and rather effortlessly heaved him against the wall. Chaz was inclined to remain crumpled in a sobbing heap for the remainder of the morning, but Toole seized him by the hair and hoisted him upright.
"You call her back right this minute," he said, slapping the phone into Chaz's limp hand. "Call her back and say you're sorry. Else I'm gonna stomp on your nuts."
As soon as Chaz gathered himself, he phoned his mother and apologized for being so rude. It was difficult, though not nearly as painful as the alternative.
It's all right, Charles. We understand, his mother assured him. You're under a great deal of stress right now.
You've got no idea, he said.
Have you thought about trying St. John's wort? It seems to be helping Roger level off.
Goodbye, Mom. Chaz gently set down the phone. Toole dragged him to the kitchen and placed him in a chair.
Where'd you go last night, Doc?
He asked.
See a friend.
Chaz was working up the nerve to tell Toole the truth, that he'd gone out and coolly, efficiently committed a homicide. Maybe the dumb gorilla would think twice about knocking him around like a rag doll. On the other hand, Chaz was fairly certain that Red Hammernut wouldn't approve of his unilateral decision to eliminate Rika Spillman. Chaz had a feeling that Red didn't trust him with any responsibilities beyond signing his name to the phony water tests. Toole said,
You took your truck off-road. The tires was covered with mud.
My friend and I went for a ride, Chaz said.
You ain't supposed to go nowheres without me.
But you were asleep, snoring like a train.
Where's that gun?
Toole asked.
I don't know.
Toole grabbed his throat.
Where's the fucking gun?
Backpack, Chaz peeped.
And where's the fucking backpack?
Hummer.
Chaz jerked a thumb in the general direction of the driveway. Toole let go of him and headed for the door. Chaz gingerly massaged his neck, congratulating himself for having had the foresight to dispose of the spent shell casings and wipe down the .38. When Toole returned, he displayed no suspicion that the pistol had been recently fired. He placed it on the counter and matter-of-factly inquired,
So, who'd you shoot?
Chaz began to stutter. Toole slapped him.
Spit it out, boy!
Obviously, the working dynamic between the two men had changed.
You're not supposed to be slapping me around, Chaz complained. You're my bodyguard, for Christ's sake!
Toole shook his head.
Not no more. Now tell me, who was it? I smelled the barrel, Doc. I know what you done.
Here goes, Chaz thought.
Remember that lady with the little blue Ford? The one who came by last week?
I remember. Your grief nurse, you said.
Yeah, well, she got it into her head to make trouble. It was going to be bad.
Is that right?
Toole said. Rika was her name. I'm pretty sure she hooked up with that asshole who's blackmailing us. I bet she's the one you saw down at Flamingo. Toole frowned.
She sure didn't look familiar.
But it was dark. And you said she wore a hat.
Yeah. But still.
He remembered the blue Ford lady as being sort of short and stacked. The one with the ball cap seemed taller and thinner.
Listen, Chaz said. I need you to help me ditch her car and go through the apartment. We should make it look like she ran out on her rent.
Toole eyed him as if he were a tick.
There's two girls you whacked. What's up with you?
Come on. Will you help me or not?
Toole dug a bottle of Mountain Dew out of the refrigerator and took a chug.
I ain't a bodyguard no more, he reiterated. Now on I'm your babysitter, is what Red says. That means I can spank your sorry ass. You don't do exactly what you're told.
My babysitter? Chaz repeated thinly. It was even more degrading than he'd feared.
I'm calling Red right now. We'll get this nonsense straightened out.
Toole shoved his cell phone at Chaz.
He's on the speed dial. Number one.
Red Hammernut was empathetic but unmoved. He said that while he was sensitive to Chaz's feelings, the gravity of the blackmail situation required that Mr. O'Toole take a more proactive role. Chaz was left with the unnerving impression that Red's goon would not be protecting him so much as holding him in custody. He was more or less under house arrest. Cheerfully, Red Hammernut added,
Relax, son. Soon as we're done with this greedy prick who's shaking us down, everything will go back to normal in your life.
Chaz doubted that seriously.
He said, You're going to pay him, aren't you?
Oh, he'll be paid. Don't you worry.
After Red said goodbye, Chaz passed the cellular back to Tool, who asked,
"How come you didn't tell him about that woman you shot?"
Chaz turned away. "Guess I forgot."
"Don't you ever set foot out of this house without me. You hear?"
"Aye, aye," Chaz said, assuming incorrectly that Tool would miss the sarcasm. Tool promptly clouted him in the head and told him to get with the damn program. Chaz shrank away, shielding himself with his arms. He was sick and tired of getting pummeled, first by the smart-ass blackmailer and now by this hairy troglodyte. He hadn't suffered so many bruises since the night he got wiped on roofies and fell down the stairs of a sorority house in Durham.
"All right, then," said Tool,
and went out back to plant a new cross that he'd uprooted off Highway 27 during the drive back from LaBelle. Chaz fixed himself a cup of black coffee. By nature, he was neither thorough nor introspective, but he reviewed with some attention to detail the events of recent days. That his stock had fallen with Red Hammernut was clear, and it caused Chaz to wonder if Red was now reconsidering his past commitments. In exchange for carrying out the Everglades scam, Chaz had been promised a plum position with Hammernut Farms, staff biologist with a fat salary, big office, slutty blonde secretary, whatever he wanted. That was the deal. They had drunk a toast and shaken hands on it. But now it seemed to Chaz as if Red was blaming him for the entire unfortunate shitstorm. From the jerk-off detective snooping around to the jerk-off blackmailer demanding $500,000. True, none of it would be happening if Chaz had not chosen to push his perfectly innocent wife off the cruise liner. How could he possibly have known that some conniving dirtbag was lurking in the shadows, watching the whole damn thing? It was unfair of Red Hammernut to lose faith so easily, to tie Chaz on a short leash and put him in the hands of a chowderhead like Tool. With a measure of bitterness, Chaz concluded that Red was underestimating him, just as his mother had underestimated him not so many years ago. He believed that Red's tepid assessment of his character might be different had he witnessed Chaz in action the night before at Loxahatchee. The smooth and unflinching way that Chaz had taken care of the Rika problem. Red surely would have been impressed, he thought. Maybe even amazed. As he watched Tool plant yet another white cross in the yard, it began to gnaw at Dr. Charles Perrone that Red Hammernut was now treating him like a liability instead of an asset. And he knew what men like Red Hammernut did with their liabilities. 23. Joey and Mick Stranahan were waiting when Corbett Wheeler's chartered Falcon landed at Tam, Miami. He stepped out wearing a long black drover's coat and, over an explosion of reddish-blonde hair, a wide-brimmed leather hat. He sported a lushly ungroomed beard, and he carried a burl walking stick of the sort favored by fast-water trout fishermen. 2 inches taller than Stranahan, Corbett Wheeler shook hands in a way that suggested the closure of a sensitive, high-stakes business deal. Then, with one ropey arm, he twirled his sister until she giggled. On the drive to Dinner Key, he insisted on sharing Polaroids of a prize ewe named Celine, a Coopworth East Frisian hybrid that had survived a nasty bout with foot rot to become Corbett's most fertile breeder. "Isn't she gorgeous?" he enthused. Mick and Joey chose to treat the question as rhetorical. To Stranahan, Corbett Wheeler confided, "These are the most peaceable creatures on God's green earth. Strange as it seems, I vastly prefer their company to humans." Stranahan said he understood completely. "There's no sort of unnatural attraction, if that's what you're wondering," Corbett added sternly. "Joey will back me up on that." She said, "It's true. Corbett is partial to women. He's been engaged, what, 3 or 4 times? He nodded remorsefully. "I'm impossible to live with. I crave my solitude."
"Then you'll approve of the island," Stranahan said.
"Yes, but first the ship."
"What a champ," Joey said.
Corbett Wheeler tipped his hat.
"Anything for you, little sister."
3 hours later, after an arduous mission to the Galleria Mall, They were standing on the fantail of the MV Sun Duchess in Port Everglades, waiting for the sun to set. Joey's brother was looking over the rail, pointing with his walking stick, saying,
"Christ almighty! I can't believe you didn't die in the fall."
"I turned it into a dive," Joey explained. "That's what saved me. 4 years on the college swim team." Stranahan noticed her shying away from the side of the ship. When he asked if she felt all right, she said,
"It's just a little creepy out here, that's all."
"We don't have to go through with this," he said.
"Like hell we don't."
Still gazing down at the water, Corbett Wheeler whistled.
"It was me, I wouldn't have made it."
"If it was you," Joey said, "you wouldn't have married someone who'd push you overboard." Her brother shrugged. "Relationships are complicated. That's why I'm partial to livestock." Stranahan watched the meandering procession of tugs and freighters and fishing boats. The roiling cross wakes would have made for an interesting ride in his skiff. "You rented this whole ship?" he asked Corbett Wheeler.
"Just for the night."
Joey asked how much it cost, and Corbett told her to mind her own business. "One of the engines is down for servicing, so the cruise line was delighted with my offer. Tomorrow they're leasing out the Commodore deck for a bar mitzvah." Joey had worn a baseball cap and sunglasses so that she wouldn't be recognized by any of the crew. According to the newspapers, Chaz had provided a photograph that was copied and distributed to all hands after she went missing. She held up a pair of large shopping bags. "Mick, are you ready?"
"How about a cocktail first?"
Joey's brother proposed merrily. "Amen," said Mick Stranahan. Tool sat down next to Maureen's bed and whispered,
"Hey there."
Her eyes opened halfway. When she smiled, Tool noticed that her lips were blotchy and dried out. For a moment, he wondered if she'd gotten sick from the gator meat that he'd brought the other night. He said,
"What's all this?"
An oxygen tube trailed to her nostrils. A plastic bag filled with fluid hung next to the bed rail on an intravenous rig, dripping into a hole in her right arm.
"I took a turn," she said weakly.
Tool tried to swallow, but found he couldn't. He stared down at the aluminum tin on his lap.
"I brung a piece of key lime pie."
"Thank you, Earl. Maybe later."
"What happened?"
He was worried and confused.
"Nothing happened. This is just how it goes."
"What? How what goes?"
Maureen said,
"Up and down, Earl. Good days, bad days."
She reached over and smoothed the shiny hairs on his hand. He was gripping the bed rail so tightly that his knuckles had gone pale.
"How's the bodyguarding business?" she asked.